This all called the meeting to order. This is a subcommittee, I guess, so we get a quorum. And we're starting with the three EVOs from Finance giving us the jurisdictional overview. Britta Wright and Alexandra Brode and Abigail Reed. Are they all okay? You have three chairs? Yes, you do have three chairs. Two. Good. Okay. Starting telling us how we're going to solve all this.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, my name is Britta Raycon with the Department of Finance. And I'm going to start just giving you an overview of the governor's approach for the supplemental budget. And you should have in your packets a handout that is just a copy of PowerPoint slides. We don't actually have the PowerPoint presentation itself with us, so you'll want to follow along with your handout.
Okay.
The first slide just gives you the key objectives that the governor used in coming to his solution. First of all, he wanted to bring the budget into balance quickly. Second, retain sufficient reserves to maintain stability of state finances. Essentially, we still have about a year and a half left of this biennium. So in case the economic situation worsens beyond what is anticipated, the governor wanted to be sure that there were still enough reserves left after the end of this session to deal with anything that occurred next year. Another objective was to begin to permanently reduce spending in order to better match the revenue growth. And you'll see as we get further into the presentation that there were reductions permanently in spending, which improves the situation for fiscal year 10 and 11. Additionally, the governor is requiring spending reductions, but also using one-time funds in order to limit the short-term impact on agencies and spending. And then lastly, maintaining essential state services that are critical to taxpayers. So the governor's 2008-2009 solution is composed of 40% in spending cuts, 35% in balance transfers from non-general fund accounts, and 25% from the general fund reserve, and that's $250 million from the general fund reserve. And that leaves $403 million in the reserve to deal with issues as they arise next year, if that's the case. The governor's plan solves to $938 million in a deficit. The $938 million is $3 million more than what you saw in the February forecast, and that's because of the passage of the transportation bill that added $3 million in spending this biennium. So as I mentioned before, 40% comes from spending cuts, that's $341 million. There's additional revenue of $157 million. Tax reductions of $88 million, new initiatives at $62 million, balance transfers from other funds, that's the Healthcare Access Fund and TANF, at $342 million, and then the use of the General Fund Budget Reserve at $250 million. Overall, the governor's plan reduces spending growth biennium to biennium from 10.3%, that's where we're at with the current budget, to 9.2%. In terms of how the reductions break out across areas in the budget, there's $187 million in reductions in the Health and Human Services area, $1 million in reductions in K-12 education, and that's just in the MDE operating budget, $5 million for aids and credits, and that's the political contributions refund and the property tax refund, $54 million for higher education, $17 million for public safety, and $78 million in other areas. When putting together his plan, the governor wanted to protect K-12 education and local government aids. So essentially, these items were taken off the table in terms of coming to the solution. K-12 education does make up 40% of the general fund budget, and local government aids 9%. So all in all, that's taking about 50% of general fund spending off the table in terms of coming to the solution. Additionally, the governor exempts Veterans Affairs, Military Affairs, and Transportation from operating cuts. And then, excuse me, also minimize the reductions to critical functions such as public safety and corrections. One thing worth noting is that the Health and Human Services reductions are achieved without affecting current eligibility or benefits. Now Alexander Brode will talk a little bit about the revenue side.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Alexander Brode from the Department of Finance. The Governor's Plan also provides additional revenues. The majority, $102 million, comes from adopting the federal definition of a foreign operating corporation. $22 million would come from accelerating the payments that we require early in June for sales tax to 85%. $21 million from repealing the current cap that we have on securities registration fees for mutual fund providers. And also, there's a proposal in the governor's budget to increase collections from tax debtors by participating in a data matching process with financial institutions. And there are a few other revenue changes that are...
Can I ask one quick question right in here? Obviously, to some of them, but are all of these changes done in the tax bill?
Except, Madam Chair, all the changes in the tax bill, except for the mutual fund cap adjustment, that's actually in the economic development area.
Okay.
And the total revenue gain is $157 million. The governor's budget also has proposals to cut taxes. A statewide sales tax cut of 1/8% is proposed, which would be $77 million cost in 2008-09. There are several federal conformity measures that have been adopted, that have been proposed and have now been adopted, but that's $8 million in 2008-09. There are two different economic development related seed strategic economic tax cuts of $3 million. And then there are a few different military service tax exemptions and benefits, including a military pay and pension exemption. And in total, the tax cuts in the governor's budget total $88 million.
Okay, and then moving on to the new initiatives. The governor's proposal does contain $62 million in new initiatives. $8 million of that is for the bonding bill, the debt service, and the cash within the bonding bill. $20 million is for the I-35W Victims Compensation Fund. The governor also includes another $20 million for the Victims Compensation Fund out of trunk highway dollars. $12 million for the governor's seed initiative. $6 million for the military and veterans package. $5 million for the K-12 initiatives that were mentioned in the State of the State address. And then $11 million for all others. And as I mentioned before, the governor does use one-time resources in order to get to the budget solution. $250 million of those one-time resources come from the general fund budget reserve. That brings the budget reserve down to $403 million. $250 million come from transfers in the healthcare access fund, and then $92 million are from TANF funds. And this is offsetting general fund spending in healthcare programs with TANF dollars. And then looking ahead to fiscal year 10 and 11, the governor's plan reduces the gap in 10 and 11 by 40%. So in the February forecast, we were projecting in 10 and 11, based on current spending, that there would be a deficit of $1,086,000,000 in 10 and 11. With the governor's budget and the reduced spending in the governor's budget, there is now projected, with this plan, $693 million deficit. Also worth noting is that $81 million of that is as a result of the transportation bill. So that's the overview, and if you have questions, we'd be glad to answer those.
Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either for Ms. Rachin and Vogt, sorry if I butchered that. The increased collections is $10 million. Mm-hmm. Is that the total amount of possible increased collections? I mean, is that all that's possible, or can you answer that for me?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is the amount that the Department of Revenue estimated of what they would collect in additional revenues as a result of matching the data with things. So it's an estimate completed by the Department of Revenue. What they think, the maximum they think they'll get, or realistic.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ward?
So, in other words, there are no other resources out there? There's no additional resource besides the $10 million?
I'll put,
John, if you notice, if you look at our agenda, the Department of Revenue is going to do a presentation on the expanded tax compliance. So the public get into that. Okay? Any other questions?
Thank you, Minister. I just missed the name of the presenter at the beginning. So I was just wondering if you could tell us your name and which office you work with.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Britta Raton, and I'm with the Department of Finance and Executive Budget Officer.
My name is Alexander Grote. I'm also with the Department of Finance, and I'm also an Executive Budget Officer.
Okay. Okay, so no particular questions for these two people. We're departing a little bit from schedule because Paul Schroeder needs to get someplace. So we told him he could be second to present the governor's office.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Schroeder, Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Pawlenty. Thank you for the opportunity to present briefly to you. The governor's budget proposal calls for approximately 4% cuts to our operating budget. That'll be approximately $150,000 from our funds. And as you know, the bulk of our funding is spent on staff. So while it's probably premature for us to say specifically how we do it, it's clear that the reduction will have an impact on our staff. And the good news is that because we have over 12 months to accommodate the adjustment, we'll likely be using a range of tools that could include maintaining open vacancies when and if they occur, some perhaps consolidation of responsibilities, and reducing non-staff related expenditures.
One of the interesting communications we've received from you fairly recently is about the shared interagency agreements with the governor, and we understand they're going from 40% to 60%. How does that come into this, and how do those get cut 4% when they've just been increased 20%?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, interagency agreements are a tool that our governor's office, this administration, and past administrations have used. I think I've testified, I know in the Senate, I'm not sure, I think I have done so with the committee, but they are a tool that are used to provide a range of services to state agencies from our office. The chief executive has a responsibility to try and see broadly the needs that there are across the administration to pull together the resources necessary. And interagency agreements are a tool that we use to do so. They're primarily focused, Madam Chair, on our legislative and cabinet affairs section of the office. This is the group of individuals who are subject matter experts who represent the governor's issue and agenda and budgetary issues before the legislature. They're folks that the legislature often interact with. We use interagency agreements in part to provide the services that those folks deliver to agencies and to the legislature.
I don't want you to feel that I'm picking on you because I objected to this from the time the first governor did it. I think it was Perpich was the master of doing this. But what if part of our budget balancing said that all of these were eliminated and either the agency picked them all up or the governor picked it all up?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I'm prepared to speculate on how we would approach that at this point. But I think it's, you know, frankly, it's fair to say that I think we should all understand the impact of that service reduction if it were to take place. As I say, this is a group of individuals who serve not just our state agencies, but also the members of the legislature as well. These are individuals who, as I say, subject matter experts in particular areas. So I don't know how many in this committee have introduced bills or chief office bills and so forth, but in many cases, I think you interact with our staff to try and gain the support of the governor for those particular initiatives, and we'd like to serve the legislature in that capacity when we can. So I think that there's a consequence that we need to understand that if that were to take place.
I thought, well, maybe we just talk to you and get
Madam Chair, I'm happy to take your call.
Well, I have a question about that and whether these positions are really necessary because, for example, in the area of transportation, dealing with the the administration on transportation bills. We have Betsy Parker, who runs government relations. We have Bob McFarland, who was the assistant to the commissioner. I never saw Jenny Glumac as a member of the Transportation Finance Committee. In terms of dealing with people on bills, we have Eric Rudine, who works on Betsy Parker's staff. So it just seems like there's ample government relations staff. You know, if we were to look at budget cuts, I just don't see any value added of having one person at the agency and one person at the governor's office. To me, it doesn't make sense that we deal with these things separately.
Madam Chair, representative, but there's only one individual who represents the governor's interest. Those individuals that you described are important, competent individuals as it relates to those particular agencies. But before she left, Jenny Glumac was the one individual who represented the governor's interest in, on a both policy and budgetary standpoint. She was the individual who reviewed the bills and legislation and provided recommendations and advice to the governor as to how to act on particular legislation that came before him. And that's a pretty important task.
That's important.
Well, I wonder if it wouldn't be more direct and more efficient for the governor to rely on staff that actually works within the agency. I mean, for example, if Jenny Glumac was the representative of the governor with regard to transportation finance, isn't it odd that as a member of the Transportation Finance Committee, I never dealt with her?
How would you know her name,
Well, it's on the list here.
Okay. Did you never interacted with Jenny Glumac?
Except for to say hi in the hallway, not really, no.
Okay. I'm sorry for taking one
I just think that when you look at the way that we have the executive branch, we have all these departments, it seems like what we're doing is we're replicating within the governor's office services that are already in the budget and performed by staff at the department. And it seems to me that that's what the commissioners and their staff are for,
sure.
Is to give the governor advice about the specifics of the agency. It just seems like a lot of duplication to have it in two places.
Madam Chair, Representative, I understand your view on that. I think we should also be mindful of the fact that, frankly, interagency agreements are not unique to the governor's office. The biggest user of them is the Attorney General's office. Last year, their report to the legislature last October indicated about $10 million in interagency agreement services that they provide to state agencies, valuable, important services. So I think I'd want to be mindful of that particular issue and how those services are provided and the impact on state agencies and the Attorney General in that respect.
Well, that was something this division in the previous incarnation was actually involved with, because it used to be that every agency had its own attorney, and that was considered to be incredibly inefficient. And so that was the back off. And so long ago, I don't even remember what it was. But what happened was that all those positions were stopped in those agencies, and there are probably some that still have them and we don't know about. And they were all moved into the Attorney General's office. So that was distinctly, you know, that was something that we didn't just edge into, but we made a decisive decision that it didn't make sense for agencies to have their own turf attorney. So.
Madam Chair, yes, I think that my recollection is the same as yours, and that those relationships and the cost components as it relates to the agencies are oftentimes provided through interagency agreements, mm-hmm. between the Attorney General's office and the 10 state agencies as well.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, I don't care how we pay for them. My question is just how many there are. So I don't know really much about this interagency thing and its history and whether that's a good way or a bad way to account for it. I'm just saying it seems like that there's four or five people who do the exact same job, and that when we're $1 billion in the hole, that maybe isn't necessary.
Okay. Mr. Schroeder, when we're looking at the governor's budget and we're looking at the percentage cut into the governor's budget, I think, and maybe we can get it by adding up all these various different columns, but what percentage of the governor's office does the governor's budget actually fund?
I'm sorry, I don't have what you have. If you have a sheet in front of you, I don't have it with me, but excuse me, I'm sorry. No.
I actually don't have it in front of me right now. Anyway, there's the governor's budget, and then meanwhile there are these interagency agreements besides that. So the question is, what percentage of the governor's office does the governor's budget actually fund?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to get the answer.
Okay. John?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably a freshman question, Mr. Smith. Not probably, this is a freshman question. I wasn't aware that the governor had an office in D.C. until recently. Can you tell me, can you teach a freshman legislator a little bit about that as far as staff and costs and what other what past governors have done as far as that office as well? Can you just give me a little history?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to do that. The Office of Federal Affairs is part of the governor's staff. There are three individuals that work in Washington on a full-time basis. We added an individual during the time that the governor was both vice chair and now chair of the National Governors Association. That position will be eliminated at the termination of the governor's chairmanship of the National Governors Association. But more broadly, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's in the $7-plus billion category of the amount of money that the state gets from the federal government on an annual basis as our portion of all the different funds the federal government gets. And these individuals represent the governor's interest and the state's interest before Congress, various state, federal agencies, the White House, and with other governors, as an example. You know, and if it's helpful, I'm more than happy to provide you and the committee a report we got recently from our Office of Federal Affairs outlining their activities that I think can probably more clearly give you some specifics on those. But there are a wide range of projects and issues that we deal with. For example, these are the folks that were instantly involved with members of the congressional delegation in getting the funding for the replacement of the I-35W bridge. We've worked on Medicare Part D issues, on national transportation issues, renewable and other energy issues on the federal level. Bird flu, and the list goes on and on. And so their job is to work with all of them to represent the state's interests before the federal government on an executive level and as well as the congressional level.
Do you know how much that costs the state of Minnesota? I understand we get $7 billion, I think you said, from the Fed before for a state program. Do you know what the cost to the state is to run that office?
I don't have the number with me, but again, I'm happy to get that.
And when you said they added a full-time staffer when the governor was the chair of the governor conference commission, so did that bring the staff before then?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair of Representatives. No, it was originally two. When
okay.
The governor became vice chair of the National Governors Association, so over about a year and a half ago, we had an additional staff person to take on to help with the responsibilities that come with that with the governor's chairmanship and vice chairmanship. And that position will be eliminated.
Again, I guess I've paid some attention to this in the past, but I'm not sure of the answers at this point. What do you do in that office in terms of cooperation with other state offices?
Sure, ma'am.
Have you ever thought about looking at joint office space or anything like that, or what?
Madam Chair, members, I don't know that we have done that in the past. There's certainly no reason why we couldn't do it. I could look into it. Most of the governors, I think every governor in the country, including Guam and Puerto Rico, have representation in the whole state. They have relatively small offices, except for the larger states like perhaps California and New York, somewhat bigger. But I think ours is probably on average about representative of the other states. And so they're co-located, so their activities are a little bit more coordinated as they try and bring together consensus on issues that are of interest to the nation's government.
So does the budget, and I, you know, again, we haven't gotten to look into all the details, but when you're talking about a 4% cut to the budget, are you looking at a 4% cut to these interagency agreements?
Madam Chair, we have not reached a conclusion on that.
Okay. That's important.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about the interagency agreements because it does bring up this issue of the governor's political staff, and usually in our hearings we're too polite to talk about anything that might be controversial, but I'll break that normal rule. It seems like we don't want to make waves when there aren't already waves out there. But it seems to me that there's been a real distance between this governor and this legislature. And it seems that this number of political people at the governor's office and at the agency is part of that distance. For example, on transportation. I mean, if the governor's advisor and person he trusts on transportation issues is the commissioner and somebody in the commissioner's office, and the legislature deals with the Department of Transportation, and we reach some agreements and we do some things based on merit, then it seems like we can move further faster than when, if we have another layer of a political lens that we have to go through, that somebody that's closer to the governor. I just think that, you know, we want to work with this governor. He says he wants to work with us, but it hasn't really gone that way. And it just strikes me that as we do our work here, we deal with people from the agencies and from the governor's staff, all really good people, all really smart people. It seems like this layer of bureaucracy we have here might be one of those things that's contributing to us not actually working that well together. Thoughts
from anybody? Representative Ames.
Madam Chair, Representative Hortman, you might want to be careful what you wish for, though, because they might make the same argument as far as the House and Senate staff and suggest that we share committee administrators with the staff members and all the host of staff members that the House and Senate are separate right now. So just, you know, as we're discussing this, careful what you wish for.
Well,
making that argument.
I hope every member of this committee would feel comfortable asking the committee administrator for anything, and we do share a chunk of nonpartisan staff, which, you know, I also hope people feel very comfortable on either side asking them for assistance or advice.
That's not what I'm referring to, meaning that we would cut our House staff and share maybe a Senate committee administrator. That's what I'm referring to.
So that's also another proposal, not quite at the committee level, but that's another proposal that this committee has made several times, that we don't, that things like administrative services and things like information, session weekly and so forth, and might better be served as a joint function than separate functions of each house. And I think we have actually made steps in, I think both, just looking at information systems, I think both Senate and House have done a good job of now using state purchasing to, no, I think so. I don't want to ever say that there's cooperation that's not documented, but I think I've heard that. So,
Madam Chair, if I could borrow your history then, has this committee ever considered, and I'm not proposing this, sharing of maybe consolidating our House research, our nonpartisan House research staff, with the Senate research staff?
I think we've actually made several proposals to come up with plans to do that, which have always been eliminated. If not eliminated, I believe Representative Sigum has several times got rid of them on the House floor. But I think if he didn't, I think they then were dissolved in conference committee. And that was when Representative Cranky was chairing the committee, and I was working with him on that issue.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, you might recall that we discussed a bit of this last year. As a matter of fact, I didn't oppose, but rather expanded upon the chair's idea of eliminating some of the assistant commissioners, and said we ought to extend some of the same reductions to the constitutional offices as well to really save some money. But I wasn't successful last year. It sounds like I might be even more successful this year, however, in some of those endeavors. But we've talked to Representative Anderson, you might remember last year, about a lot of things along those lines, about streamlining and saving money, which would have helped now that we're $935 million in as well. And Representative Portman, I would agree with you as well about contact with folks. I know that we've had discussions in this committee with certain state agencies and the like, smaller ones who will say our job is to advise the legislature, and I've polled our entire caucus, and some of them will say they've never been visited by certain of these agencies in their entire careers. including me going on 6 years having been visited by some. So I really think these are good ideas for budget reductions, and some of them were unsuccessful, but maybe they will be successful this time around.
Well, we look forward for any member of the committee who has any thoughts of what would be a good idea. We certainly would like them given to us, either confidentially or publicly or whatever. Any other questions of Mr. Schroeder?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now we're going back to Australia. We're starting with finance. Stephanie Andrews. And I guess each agency is going to tell us what they're thinking about doing with the governor's suggestion. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thanks for having me here today. Stephanie Andrews, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Finance. I think you've asked us to just talk through the effect of the governor's recommendations on our agency budget. And so just to remind you, switching gears from the presentation you saw earlier from our budget staff at the Department of Finance, now I'm going to talk to you about the operational side of the Department of Finance. The budget recommendation in the governor's budget is a combined recommendation for the Department of Finance and the Department of Employee Relations. As you recall, last year legislation was passed that merges our agencies effective June 1st. And so the recommendation includes $842,000 a year, which is 4% a year, and that again is 4% of the combined budget for employee relations and finance. In terms of how we will manage that reduction, over 80% of our agency funds are in costs related to personnel, salaries and benefits. And so we have relatively few reductions other than personnel changes in order to manage those reductions. We expect that the 4% reduction will mean the elimination of 10 positions in the department, 8 to 10 positions depending again on specifically what those are. And hopefully we will achieve those reductions through retirement and attrition. At this point in time, we're holding vacancies open. I think you're aware that most agencies are doing that. There is a hiring restriction on executive branch agencies. And so we're doing that anyway. We've been managing those very closely for a long time anyways in the past, and we'll continue to do so. We have two uncertainties, though, as we talk about what the specific positions are that we're going to be eliminating. One of those is that one of the things that we're including in our budget plans are anticipated retirements for some people. And obviously, some of those are simply anticipated retirements. We think that people are on their way to some other part of their lives, but the economic uncertainty affects those people, too. And so we've heard informally and formally that some of those people are actually delaying some of their plans to retire. And so in order to achieve the reductions, we're again trying to manage what we think will happen in order to get us to the numbers that we need to get to. We also then are also adjusting that list of positions that we plan to eliminate so that we can be sure that the positions that we're keeping are really focused on our highest priority activities. Just a quick example, we had somebody who left our financial reporting area to go to another agency. And as you may remember from your discussion of the OLA audit on financial reporting, that's an area where we continue to have some challenges in terms of providing the level of oversight and assistance that we want to agencies. And so we, in order to make sure that that position stayed funded, we moved a position from agency assistance over into financial reporting. But that area already had a vacancy that we were holding as part of our reduction plan. So now they weren't able to carry two vacancies. We're now kind of reconfiguring those two vacancies into one, which is kind of a brand new position that we're filling and a brand new position we'll be eliminating. And so those kind of decisions are the kind of decisions we expect to continue to have to make as we go forward. In terms of managing the budget reduction. We also have relatively little flexibility because, again, as you know, the Department of Finance and Employee Relations, we manage the statewide systems, the MAPS, and the 704 systems, and so some of those, there's relatively little flexibility, again, although we keep looking for it in how we manage those systems. And, again, most of our reductions then come more in the area of what we think of as kind of our value-added parts of the agency, our analysis. Folks who do analysis are folks who do, again, technical assistance and oversight, and so we expect to see continued challenges in meeting some of those responsibilities. But, again, we also recognize the challenge that the governor's budget had in resolving a billion-dollar deficit, and we're ready to manage these as best we can.
Yeah. haven't we put a chunk of money into improving those systems that you have to manage, and shouldn't that help you manage them?
Madam Chair, which systems specifically are you talking
maps
about?
And
certainly,
quality.
Madam Chair, as you know, we've been talking about MAPS replacement for a long time. Last session, the legislature appropriated $500,000 in planning funds for us to begin work on planning for a MAPS replacement project. That's been a project in our sights for quite a while. Our system currently was put into place in the mid-90s, and it's time for replacement. And so, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We've gotten started. The governor's budget, due to the economic circumstances, wasn't able to include the full somewhere between $50-60 million appropriation for that project, but we hope to come back and talk to you about that again.
And then another question, which I feel like asking every agency that's not really a hands-on agency. We've put all kinds of language in law that's supposedly encouraging telecommuting. And I understand it's not necessarily a budget reduction area, but, you know, we've heard lots of things. Representative Hilty isn't here anymore, but he's been giving us long lectures on peak oil, and telecommuting is one of the best. You know, when are we going to see some real moves towards being able to measure productivity by of workers by other than seat time?
Madam Chair, that's an interesting question and probably will be even more in our department's purview as we bring in human resources into our agency. We use telecommuting a lot in the Department of Finance already, are continuing to figure out ways to use it effectively. I think that as you suggest, that shift in orientation for managers to get used to really talking about what they're looking for them from their employees as opposed to seat time is a significant transition. We've been successful so far. We think that as you point out, it isn't necessarily a budget issue. It certainly is a recruitment and retention issue, and that's one of the places where we continue to look at ways to use it so that we can make sure that the good people that we hire, we can keep, and we'll keep looking at that.
Okay. Well, I don't expect you to do this now, and when you say you're using it increasingly, can we see some data on that? Can we see some, do you have any information you have about how many people were doing it 2 years ago, how many are doing it now, any profit, and any prognosis of what you have for looking at it in the future?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm not sure actually that we have it on a statewide basis, but I'll be happy to talk to you. It's certainly something, again, that we should look at.
Starting even in your department, mm-hmm. starting department Absolutely. By department instead of trying to get the complete mm-hmm. picture. Okay. Any other?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about the 35W Bridge Collapse Victims Compensation Fund. There's been some people saying that maybe the $40 million level is too much. Maybe under the circumstances, maybe we need to rethink that. Has there been any projections on looking at the victims and what they what is projected and what we actually would need there?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to ask Abigail Reed to come up and answer that. That is one of the non-operating funds of finance, and she's probably better able to answer that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Abigail Reed. I'm also a budget officer at the Department of Finance, and in that capacity, help prepare the finance non-operating account information for the governor's budget. It's a series of accounts that handle the kind of statewide financial management of the state. And the governor's budget includes $20 million in the general fund and $20 million in the Trunk Highway Fund. That was included as a placeholder for the 35W Bridge Collapse Victims Fund because discussions were ongoing with the House and the Senate and the governor. And so we expect that will continue to develop as the proposals move through both houses and you continue working with the governor on that.
There's a little problem that, you know, and I guess I'm not the person to raise it. I think there are people who are more protective of the Trunk Highway Fund than I am. But there is the concept of the appropriateness of taking this from the state, from the Trunk Highway, of suggesting taking part of it from the Trunk Highway Fund. Does anyone want to tell us how the decision was made to do that?
I'm not prepared today to talk about exactly how the decision was made. I know the discussion has been because transportation is funded from both sources to look at various sources as a way to put that in. But as I said, it is a placeholder, and so it was put in for discussion and to continue working with both houses on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to be more specific on my question, again, $40 million is a lot of money, and we have a very finite number of people who are affected here. It would make sense for us to do an analysis, interview those people, and find out if we can at least put, at least to what, beyond what to this point, at least as I understand, has not been a solid estimate on what the needs are there. Has any of that been put forward?
Madam Chair, Representative, definitely what we used in preparing the budget were based on estimates that did not include detailed information about the victims, the extent of their injuries, and any other circumstances that may affect them. And that was understood as we went forward. I understand that staff from the House and the Senate have had more direct contact with the city and also with victims and the fund that Minneapolis has set up and other organizations, and they may have actually more detailed information. We do understand that the Senate in particular was working directly with lawyers and other folks and may have more detailed information. Those were not included when we used the original estimates in the governor's budget because we understood that conversation to be ongoing.
Ms. Van Fulton?
I was wondering if the use of a trunk highway in this way had been evaluated by council for whether it's constitutional or not. The way I read this, from what I know about the trunk highway fund, the gas tax and the tap fees are constitutionally dedicated to only be spent on roads and bridges, and so to me that would be unconstitutional, and so what it looks like is a $20 million appropriation for the bridge victims. Do you know if the governor has any legal opinion to support the idea of using the trunk highway funds this way?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not a transportation and budget analyst, and so unfortunately I can't answer that question, but I'm happy to double check. I understand that transportation analysts were involved in this discussion, and I imagine that they did address that question. And we do use transportation trunk highway funds for things like this.
I would imagine
that would be the situation. I'm sorry, I'll get you more information.
Madam Chair, I can hold my question. It isn't related to the compensation fund, so
okay.
I can hold off until we're done with that.
I'll ask Ms. Rita. Actually, I had a question about the budget reserve. You know, we've got a budget reserve of about $653 million, and that's being tapped to a certain extent, and I'm wondering if you can speak to the rationale behind tapping the fund to the extent that it was, the $250 million. What was the rationale behind selecting $250 million out of a $653 million reserve?
As Ms. Raytheon said, the $250 million was used as a way to help bring the budget into balance, and that was a portion of the budget reserve that does leave $403 million available for the remainder of the biennium should we continue to have crisis. Sorry, thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, Ms. Rita, are there guidelines that's used? Is there a certain amount that you want to leave in the budget reserve? Is there a certain amount you're required to, for example, by bond council? That I guess is what I was looking for. As opposed to generally 250, I mean, why not 300 million, for example?
There are a number of factors that go into that decision, bond council, and what they look at is obviously part of it. My understanding from what our commissioner and Judge Showalter mentioned in their presentations to Finance and Ways and Means was that what bond council looks at is a holistic picture that includes things like the cash flow account, that's an additional $350 million, and a variety of other factors. And so all of that goes into the decision, as well as trying to minimize the impact of variances in revenues on agency expenditures, so trying not to allow the changes in revenues to affect agencies significantly in any given year. Those are all factors that go into the decision.
All right, thank you. Madam Chair, I find it somewhat ironic, and it's a policy discussion for another day, that we have this budget reserve for financial difficulties, and then we never seem to touch it in any significant way. I don't know, that's not the way my household operates. We got an emergency fund, and we tap it when we have an emergency. We don't say, hey, we got a problem here. We're going to have to do something else. It's a debate we ought to have, because, as you know, I'm dubious from a philosophical perspective that government ought to be having budget reserves of any kind. Reasons like this, it just seems to sit there as a pot of money nobody can touch.
Well, this is
unavailable to government and the taxpayers. Yes.
Well, Representative,
but there for the,
this is the first time that anyone's actually proposed to even take part of it. So
right.
That's a step forward.
Yeah.
The proposal that I've had for years, which is, and I think it's following up on what you're saying, that we collect the budget reserve by overtaxing people to fill it. Now, if the bond, if that helps us, now there are some places that have said that keeping that money is actually not an effective, that spending more on bonds is actually a better use of money than keeping that money tucked away. I'm not enough of a financial analyst to tell you that, but one of the things that the agencies that the bonding companies have told us anyway, that any kind of stabilization would be fine. And so we could do what I've called a revenue adjustment act, which would just be, if your budget reserve was tapped into enough to affect your bonding rating, you could then add a surcharge on income tax, which would mean, first of all, it would have to be very tiny. It wouldn't need to be very big to fill that much of a budget reserve. And second of all, the advantage of, instead of collecting tax from everyone and squirreling it away, at the point that you'd apply it, you'd only be collecting from the people who hadn't been hurt by the downturn, besides the fact that it would be a tiny amount that you'd be collecting. So I've always thought that was a more sensible way of doing it. But...
Well, Madam Chair, I'd love to have a hearing to more fully explore that. And this isn't chump change. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and it seems like it's unavailable to government and the citizens in an interest-bearing account, I'm sure.
I'm sure it's being invested by the state.
But I've always found it just somewhat ironic that we've got money with a big pot we can't touch.
The low part probably has to be in pretty available money. We can have the State Board of Investment talk about that, too.
We need Mr. Bicker in.
Madam Chair, Representative, just a couple of points. One of the important things to remember about the budget reserve, and certainly what we talk about with the rating agencies, is that it isn't so much in what the specific level is, so certainly they like more rather than less. It's how you use it. It's what your plan is to refill it if you use it. And in terms of cash flow, we also are at a place where the cash flow account doesn't, in fact, meet our cash flow needs, and so we also need to use part of the budget reserve for that. We'd be happy to come and talk to you about cash flow needs, too, if you're interested at some point, because it is, as we move into a place where we are certainly going to have fewer reserves, it is something that we're watching very closely.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is, I don't necessarily disagree with you, Representative De La Force. I get the fact that it's a rainy day fund, and like when my furnace went out, you know, I had to tap my savings to, you know, pay for a new service, and I guess that's what this is about. But my question is that if we would deplete it or bring it down below a certain level, doesn't that affect our bond rating with other agents, with the bonding houses? And the other question is that wouldn't we, in order to bring it down, like you were saying, we would have to have a plan on how to reestablish the rainy day fund again before we could even have it be an option?
Madam Chair, Representative, as you said, the rating agencies do look at our entire ability to be able to meet our obligations as a state, the spending that we've anticipated that we're planning to make. And so this is what they look like. The rationale for leaving $403 million or an additional amount in the budget reserve for the future use is that we have a year and a half left in the biennium. And should we overpromise what we can do with our spending, then we have actually limited ability to get additional resources towards the end of the biennium. If you raise taxes, you don't have time to collect it. If you try to raise revenues in other ways, you may not be able to administer that in time to meet the shortfall. And that is the rationale for having an additional amount in the budget reserve going forward for the rest of the biennium.
And Madam Chair, thank you. My point is that I think if by depleting the reserves, which again I'm not objective to, I just think we would have to be cautious and it'd have to be a right number. But to me that's more of a short-term, short-distance fix. And I think we also ought to be looking long-term at how to weather the storm. And that would be my concern about draining the reserves. But recognizing that I also understand it seems like it's this pot of taxpayer dollars that never gets touched. When it's a rainy day fund. So I'm not arguing that we don't touch it. I'm just saying we ought to be cautious and careful about how much we do use.
Well, maybe this constitution, I don't know who else is on GovOps, but this constitutional amendment that we have before us that allows the legislature, the spending legislature, to call itself back into session, maybe that will impress the bonding company that we have another avenue. We don't just have to depend on the governor calling a special session.
And Madam Chair, we should also admit that all of us with election certificates love to have this budget reserve because it spares us from more painful decisions down the road if the economy goes south, right? Always nice to have that to be able to touch as opposed to making more difficult decisions.
Okay, thank you very much. Actually, we were honored by having one of our constitutional offices here, and so since she actually has other places to go, so because of only one who came herself and didn't send a surrogate, we'll go to Rebecca Otto at this point.
She used to be one of us.
That's
sure.
Right, that's why.
Not afraid
okay.
Of us.
And Chair members, Rebecca Otto, State Auditor, and I do want to point out that it is me. And talking to the governor yesterday, we serve on three state boards together, and I was talking about some of the committees I go and listen to because of the board work we do, and he looked at me and said, well, you're a regular lobbyist. But what I said to him is I work hard for our office because we have very little staff. That's why I'm here, because I don't have staff that gets to come and do this for me. But I did drag some staff with me today to help me. We're going to do a brief presentation for you, very brief, and I'm all about reduce, reuse, recycle, and so this is a presentation we did for you last year, much shortened up and updated with our numbers, okay? All right, and then we can answer questions. All right. So for those of you that don't know what we do, it's okay if you don't because a lot of people don't. We help Minnesota's local governments succeed by providing the tools and resources necessary to be successful stewards of over $20 billion a year in public funds during this budget cycle. So we oversee more money than the legislative auditor does, and you see his reports quite often. We're responsible for a very large amount of money. And we do this through auditing of local governments. We do this through investigations when people report theft or misuse of public funds. We do this through reporting. We're an accountability and transparency office around the local government level, so citizens can see what their local government finances are, so that the media can help us do that, and so that you all can see what's going on. And we also educate. We work hard to educate our local government entities so that when they make decisions to spend tax dollars, that they are successful and they follow the rules. And they're set up in a way so that people can't steal money. Okay? All right. Our budget. We're supposed to be addressing what a 4% reduction would do to our budget. So our fiscal year 2009 budget, 85% of our budget, which that pie chart shows on the screen, is, first of all, recovered by fees and reimbursements or offsets. We have a very tiny impact on the general fund. First of all, we're a very small office. And second of all, we have a very small impact on the general fund. So 85% is recovered through offsets and fees. We did another bar graph for you. This is portion recovered by fees and reimbursements versus general fund by division. So the dark bluish purple is, for instance, for audit division. Let me pull out mine because I can't see that very well. All right. For the audit division, everything is, and that's the biggest part of our office, it's all, thank you. It is all, everything is recovered through fees. Government Information Division is almost 100%. Pension is over half. Operations Management is almost all. Job Z is almost completely recovered. The two areas that aren't are Legal and Special Investigations and Constitutional Office. Constitutional Office supports my work on six state boards, including State Board of Investment, where we oversee $60 billion a year, or we invest that, and we're responsible for it. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency Board, where we're the sixth largest bank in the state, and we deal with a lot of money. We work on affordable housing. The Public Land Exchange Board, the PARA Board, which is public pensions, and the Executive Council. I think I've gotten all of them. So that's just to support my work there, and that's my general counsel and deputy auditor. The Legal and Special Investigations Division is not covered through fees and offsets because when there's a statute, 609, it's a 609 section, that requires local officials when they suspect misuse of public funds or theft of public funds, they have to report to our office and we follow up. If we were to charge them for our services, some of them would hesitate to call us. We have to let them call us without fear of it costing their entity, because they're calling us because there may be a problem with the, they may be losing money and or money being misused or stolen. We don't want them not calling us because they're afraid it's going to have another impact on their local government. So we provide that service free of charge. It's very important to do that so that they are willing to come forward and report to us. Final slide. We're not quite final yet. We wanted to show you expenditures by cost group for 2009 budget, and as you see, 89% is personnel. So the state auditor's office is people, and we, if you look at our other expenditures, which I wanted you to take a quick look at, we don't own any of our buildings. We rent. It's only 5%. Travel is 1%. Communication is 1%. This office is incredibly efficient, and it's people that have to go out and do that oversight work. The net benefit to the general fund, the recommended cut is 4%, which is $369,360. By cutting our budget by $369,360, the general fund is only going to net $80,544. You're not going to get $369,000 because of our fees and offsets.
Let me understand that. I thought that was true, but let me have that. We go back to your first pie chart. The 4% covers that whole blue and the red. The 4% cut covers both the blue and the red.
Yes.
Whereas,
yes,
it only makes sense. I mean, I'm not going to argue with the 4%, but particularly because every time you cut part of the of this, you don't get reimbursed. You spend it and then you don't get reimbursed. So cutting anything of the blue on page 3 is essentially a wash to the fund balance. Because if you don't spend it, you can't get reimbursed for it.
That's correct.
So if we're going to hold you harmless, like if we're going to treat you like everyone else, the only place it would make sense to take the 4% is of the 15%. I'm not saying that that's what we're going to do. I'm saying, but it really doesn't make sense to take it from the money that once we take it, you don't get reimbursed for it.
Right. Yes, Madam Chair, and we can talk about that in a moment. So by cutting us by 4%, you're not getting $369,000. You're going to get $80,544. So the final slide is this. It's a significant loss to the Office of State Auditor. We have a very small staff to begin with. So a budget reduction of $369,360. Your general fund, the net benefit is $80,554. The loss of staff for us is 5 staff positions. That's a whole division. That is a whole audit team. We're already very short. 2003, the cuts were devastating to our office. And I don't think the public expects less oversight. I think they expect more. And in a time of economic downturn, I sent out an email to other state auditors, comptrollers, and treasurers, and I got an email today from one of them. It was said, is there evidence of when there's economic downturns, there's greater theft? And they said, actually, they were a judge on the bench, and they saw it every day. When there's an economic downturn, people get desperate and do things. So we don't want less oversight in government. We want more in an economic downturn. And it's not that I'm not willing to do my part, but I can tell you, I have put procedures into place in that office to make sure we're tracking things, that we're as efficient as we can be. We have, you need to understand the nature of our work is very conservative. And we're helping local governments be to do prudent fiscal management. So we're all about that in our office. We don't have anything left because we are so good at it ourselves, and we're so, our work processing people, which we have to have because we put out so many reports, aren't even in the office unless we have work for them. I don't have as many deputy state auditors as the past state auditor had. I'm more conservative. I only have two. She had three. One of them is my general counsel. I have to have a general counsel in my office because of the boards I serve on. We get served for MHSA. So I don't know where else we would cut at this point. And if we wanted to take from some of the divisions that aren't reimbursed, like legal and special investigations, there will be no more special investigations. We will not be following up on theft. We will not be writing a legal and compliance audit guide for local governments and for CPAs that do auditing of local governments. There will not be statements of position helping local governments understand how to deal with statutes, AG opinions, and things like that. I just want to tell you the way it is. If you want to get a constitutional office, that's going to be really interesting because there's not much to it. I get an executive assistant. My executive assistant provides support to the rest of the office. They don't do anything for me. They answer our phones. They provide security at the front door so that we don't have any more theft of the computer or private information of our citizens. I mean, we are stripped. And we're a very small staff. This is devastating to our office. And I don't think the public expects less transparency of local government, less accountability, or less oversight. And I don't know, we're already struggling to get the work done that we need to get done. And we have very professional staff that work very hard. One other thing I wanted to point out to you, and OLA has probably talked to you about this too, but on the business section, there was an article about accounting, and there is going to be a major shortage of accounting people. We're doing a workforce plan right now in our office because we're trying to figure out how we're going to have enough auditors in our office to meet the demands of our work. And we're going to be over 3,000 people short in the Twin Cities of auditors to fill in 2014. So right now, we're trying to attract and retain the young people and keep them and get them up to speed so that they can fill the positions of the other folks that are retiring because we have retirements coming. So this could not be coming at it. I mean, this is the worst time if we're going to continue to do oversight in government. And my opinion on oversight in government is after having served in this office, you don't have government unless you have oversight.
Well, I'd like to ask you, I guess, because your work is kind of similar, same question I asked people from finance. What are you doing about telecommuting? What are you doing to encourage it? Where have you been, and what are you looking to get on it? It seems like it's, again, a natural to your office. You have a lot of people who actually end up doing not just actual commuting, but you have them moving into other locations on cities to do their auditing and so forth.
Madam Chair and members, we are, I'm doing a strategic plan for my office. I'm doing it. I don't have people hired to do it. I've done a lot of research. I've been talking to the state auditors trying to do best practices. The telecommuting piece for us is really going to be a part of our retention because it is attractive to some staff. And so what we've done is gathered some of the HR policies from some of the state agencies who are doing telecommuting to see what they allow and how they structure it. Some have very long policies. Some have short ones. And so with our strategic plan and our workforce planning and our succession planning to make sure that we meet our needs as state government in the near future, because I care about this office for many years to come, we're going to be looking at that as a piece and deciding which positions it's appropriate for and what we want to have in place in terms of criteria. We've become much more electronic, and so I said to our staff, we need to rethink how we do it. It's not going to necessarily save us any money, but it will be something attractive to staff for retention.
Any other questions of yours? I guess one question, which, and I guess it's more to the people who structure the budget. Suppose we changed the structure of your office and we eliminated your appropriation and had you just work on fees. And then you kept the fees, instead of going through the central budget, we give you an appropriation and then your fees come in to offset that. And you've got to give us some ideas to what your intended. Suppose we just totally eliminated that and we just went to maybe like a private CPA, you'd have to keep records and tell us what you were doing. But suppose we just
zeroed you out in the state budget.
Madam Chair, that makes me a little nervous when you say things like that. But I would...
it used to work that way.
Right, right. And I'm going to let Matt respond to that. Matt was with our audit division for many years, and he's actually a person that wears about 10 hats in our office and keeps lots of things going, and he still smiles. But he can...
If he knows who is the person who changed the system.
But. Yeah, but can I ask a quick question before you speak, Matt? My question for you is, are you suggesting that all of our fees come from local government? I just want to clarify that. And we wouldn't be taking, it wouldn't be LGA anymore, and it wouldn't be, or are you just saying you wouldn't run it through the general fund?
We just wouldn't run it through the general fund. I'm suggesting that we wouldn't run it through the general fund. Whatever
Madam Chair,
instead of a reimbursement system, we get rid of this part of the budget.
Madam Chair, my name is Matt Lindemann. I'm the Director of Budget Finance and Technology for the State Auditor's Office. It's a real hard question to really answer since the time I've been with the office. We've been a general fund appropriation. I think that would probably work okay for our audit division. Obviously, there's probably a lot of consideration to be taken.
I obviously exaggerated by saying the whole office. But the things that you bill for, suppose you just stop doing that from the general fund.
I think the only division that we really bill for is the audit division. Yeah. The government information division, the expenditures in that division are a reduction to local government aid. The expenditures in our pension division are a reduction to pension aid. So those are really just, they're not really revenues to the state, but they're a reduction of expenditures somewhere else. So the model really would work fine for our audit division with, and I'm not sure exactly
it's
what.
It's part. It's the blue part. Isn't
the blue
it?
Part also.
But that also includes the local government aid and the.
Yes, we call it offsets because it's not really just revenue, but it's a reduction in expenditures in other places of the government, particularly local government aid and pension aid. So.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, we'll go back to the, unless there's any other reason. I don't know if we'll finish today, but we'll go back to military affairs in the unique position of having money given to them. Okay, General Salido, how nice to see you.
Madam Chair, excuse me. My name is Larry Salato. I'm the Adjutant General for the State of Minnesota. And with me is Terry Palmer, who will be going over our budget items, and Eric Aldis, who is my representative and liaison to this body. What I'd like to do is take a few moments to just give you an update. All of you should have received a copy of our annual report, which is for fiscal year 07, which ended in October 1st. Since that time, the operational tempo of the Minnesota National Guard has remained a relatively constant level. As you are aware, we brought back 2,600 of our men and women from Iraq in late July. They went through and finished up their reintegration process on the structured format and are now reintegrating into the community. A good story, if you haven't seen it, is the front page coverage in the Star Tribune for last Sunday and yesterday for sure, talking about just the issues that are related to that. But since January 1st, I went to Iraq, and we had the, over in Iraq, we have our 2nd Battalion 147th Aviation. You may or may not have seen them in the Parade magazine and also in the Star Tribune. But their latest claim to fame, if you will, is on Christmas Day. They fueled, manned, or operated, flew, store gunned, everything, two birds, all female. It was a collection of female aviators from the great state of Minnesota, Hawaii, and Washington State. We believe that to be a first. And again, one of them was featured in the Parade magazine, which is 400 newspapers and about a 32 million readership. The 148th is, as we speak today, should be flying back from Anchorage, Alaska. In the last fiscal year, or 12-month period, the 148th Fighter Wing out of Duluth, Minnesota, has been the most actively deployed fighter wing in the United States Air Force. They've been to Iraq. They've done security missions out of Shaw Air Force Base, Tyndall Air Force Base, Hawaii. They did so well in Hawaii, they were given a treat of doing it now in Alaska. They also, when they're flying back home, will bring with them a small little pack that has a red star on it. First of all, they're the first unit ever to be from outside the state of Alaska to provide Alaskan sovereignty. And they are one of about three units since the end of the Cold War that have personally intercepted and guided a stray Russian bear recon element out of the American airspace. The 133rd is out of the Minneapolis St. Paul Airport, is getting ready for an Afghan rotation. They'll be going. Both units this past year did something we believe, again, is unprecedented for any one state. Both of them have been rated in the top 10% of the units in the United States Air Force, active, guard, or reserve. As they are preparing, also the 34th Combat Aviation Brigade is preparing and will be going to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, in preparation to go into Iraq in May. And they'll be providing airlift operations and commanding and controlling aviation units from multiple states. As we speak, you may have seen the elections in the independence declared in Kosovo. You may have seen Serbians standing at a gate or a guard station on the border screaming and yelling at a person in a uniform such as mine. If you look very carefully at that photo, you would have seen the Red Bull patch of the Minnesota National Guard there. We have 400 and some that are there. Currently, I have over 1,300 men and women in the Minnesota National Army and Air Guards somewhere in 17 different countries. Also, we have just received home our personnel units that were in Afghanistan and in Kuwait and Iraq. They were the ones that received any personnel that were coming into theater or leaving theater and doing the processing there, and anyone going on their two-week leave. The finance unit was rated one of the top two finance units in CENTCOM. It's not just the Iraqi and Afghan theater, but throughout that entire region, active Army and Reserve. But what we're most proud of and what we really are appreciative of this body is the way Minnesota has taken care of their soldiers when they have returned home. We in Minnesota call it Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. Nationally, it has been approved and is now referred to on a national level as the Reintegration Program. It was identified in the National Defense Authorization Act. We're still trying to clarify the funding that will follow it, but right now what we do know is that it was not in the President's budget, and our congressional delegation, and I know from earlier discussion, the team with the Governor's Office in D.C., have been extremely instrumental in helping us track this down to find out where is the dollars so that we can get that going. So this is an update, and I just want to emphasize that before I turn it over to Mr. Palmer, is that the Operation Temple, there is more coming that I cannot talk about at this time, so it's not over until it's over. So, Madam Chair, that's a update from the initial briefing till now. I will tell you, in talking to the people in Iraq, in Kuwait, in Hawaii, which are like, in Anchorage, the morale is exceptional, absolutely exceptional. The most common issues the people are concerned about back home, are they properly equipped? Yes, they are. Properly fed and taken care of? Yes, they are. And one of my taskings going into country, the reason they allow me to go into country, is to find out what are the issues that the soldiers are having, and airmen. And most of them are basically what I would call creature comfort or real soft issues that are needing to be taken care of. Minnesota, you can be very, very proud, is an extremely well-respected military organization in the National Guard nationally, and I'm talking about that as it's in theater. At this time, subject to your questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Palmer.
Madam Chair, committee members, staff, Terry Palmer, I'm the Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs. I'll go through our presentation based on Ms. Roberts' handout, the spreadsheet. All of our supplemental budget requests are the governor's proposals that he had previously announced. And I'll go through each one. The first proposal is for in fiscal year 9 is $180,000 for a state navigator. And what that is a joint office between Department of Military Affairs and Department of Veterans Affairs. It's a director and two support staff who will help all these soldiers that are returning, soldiers and airmen that are returning, find their way through some of those programs that are available to them in state agencies that they may or may not be aware of. And that's 60% of the total shows up in Department of Military Affairs. The other 40% shows up in Veterans Affairs. The next issue is medic requalification bonus. Over half of the department's budget has to do with enlistment incentives that the legislature has provided to members of the Minnesota Air National and Army National Guard. And this is another piece that we would like you to consider. It's a request for $135,000 per year. What it amounts to is a biannual bonus, a recertification bonus for medic personnel to maintain their emergency medical certification. If you look at the handout we gave, there's a map of the state that shows the density of the people where they're located. The state Minnesota National Guard currently has 388 medics. And the medical people are a little unusual relative to all other members of the National Guard. Beyond their normal military service training that they do, they also have to do continuing educational units to maintain their National Register of Emergency Medical Technician certification. So in recognition of that and try to encourage them to continue on with those, so that they are not only available to the Minnesota Guard, but also to the citizens of the state when the Guard's called out for emergencies, we're asking that you consider a bonus program for those people so that they will be encouraged to continue their certification. Of that 388 current, about 300 of them will have to be recertified in 08 and 09. So that would be a huge loss to the state if those persons were not able to do that. There's also a request for a $75,000 appropriation in 09, which would be a $35,000 a year appropriation in the out years. And that's for a state employer support of the Guard and Reserve program. There's a federal program currently that recognizes the employers of members of the service that go above and beyond what is expected of people through USERRA and all the other laws. So they actually provide some additional assistance to military members that have to go and serve their country. And what this program is intended to do is to recognize the employer of the spouses of those service members, because when a National Guard member, or a member of the reserve component for that matter, goes to war, their family also goes and so does their employer. So what we're hoping to do here is to recognize those employers of the spouses of service members who provide some additional benefits or help them help their spouse stay in the military and serve their country and state. And the fourth item in the department's proposals is the spousal use of the tuition reimbursement program. As the Adjutant General and the Governor traveled and visited troops all around the world that were deployed, there were a number of issues that they relayed to the Adjutant General and to the Governor about things that they would consider to be of great benefit to them to help them maintain their membership in the military. And one of those things was allowing the spouse of a service member who is currently eligible for the tuition reimbursement program to use those benefits that are unused by the service member. And we under the current statute and the current appropriation, we feel that 09 would not need any additional funding, but in 2010 and 11 we would ask for an appropriation for that program. And there is.
What I don't quite understand is, if using the unused benefit, why would you need a greater appropriation for it? And why if it isn't, you're not increasing the benefit, are you?
Madam Chair, no. What happens is about 20% of the Guard members use the tuition reimbursement program. So this would be probably applicable to some of that other 80% that do not use the program, or that do not use it in total, because either they do not pursue their education beyond 2 years, or because they've chosen some other career path that doesn't require a college degree. But essentially, that's what it would do. There are benefits that a service member would be entitled to, but they don't use them. So it would, in effect, increase the number of people participating in the program.
Okay.
And then finally, Madam Chair, there's another, it's an expenditure change. It's the Camp Ripley Land Fund proposal. It shows up as $100,000 reduction to the general fund. Currently, the timber at Camp Ripley is managed by the DNR, and that timber sale proceeds go into the general fund. The problem that we currently have is that the DNR manages timber for purposes different from what the department would manage it for if we were allowed to at Camp Ripley. They like a lot of quick-growing, fiber-rich products that they can sell. Our goal is to provide longer lasting trees, if you will, and to make those lands more palatable and suitable for military training. And if someone comes in to cut timber and they leave the tree stumps there, that really creates some problems for us, but typically the DNR is not concerned about the tree stumps. It's not part of the contract for the person cutting the timber to remove those stumps. So what this does is allows the Department of Military Affairs to keep some of that revenue to better manage the forest at Camp Ripley for the purposes of training military people. And all of these do have a language associated with them, either statutory changes for the most part, too, Madam Chair. So that concludes my brief.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
I don't think we're going to finish everybody that's on this. We'll go until someone comes and kicks us out of the room. Continuing in order, let's go with the Department of Administration. Donna Bedro. What? Our plan is to bring people back on Tuesday the 18th. There's anyone who knows that they can't do that, but...
Madam Chair and members, Nina Badger of Department of Administration. I have with me Lenora Madigan, our Chief Financial Officer. It's a hard act to follow when we do central mail and recycling. You hear the wonderful services of that last state agency. But as long as we're on that topic, Madam Chair and members, you have a handout, I believe, that we distributed that actually summarizes or gives some detail around our cuts. And if you actually turn to the reverse of that, it talks about a governor's request for additional funding, which is related to that last series of programs that Mr. Palmer just described, having to do with the governor's programs for veterans. And this would create a preference in state contracting for veteran-owned businesses, much like the preferences that we currently give to minority and women-owned businesses owned by the disabled. We give us up to 6% preference for certified veteran-owned businesses.
Okay. We had a discussion about this last year, and I think at least our position was that this seems like a pretty broad-based benefit unless we limited it to the veterans of the current affair. This is for all veterans, World War II veterans.
Madam Chair and members, that is the governor's proposal. I do recall that discussion from last year, and of course we would be prepared to implement it either way. Whatever the definition, we will require some additional resources to set up the program, certify the vendors, and it would be slightly fewer resources than we're requesting here.
Okay.
If we wanted to then go back to the previous page, we'll talk about our budget reductions. Like most other state agencies, we were given a 4% target for our reduction.
And let me just start off by saying that that is 4% of our general fund, which, much like the state auditor, is a relatively small percentage of our total budget. In fact, our target amount is $469,000. We have always the usual factors when the Department of Administration looks at budget cuts. First of all, we have a lot of statutory obligations in 16A, B, and C, as well as the data practices statutes. So we must maintain sufficient staff to implement those statutory obligations. And then the second factor is that we perform services for state agencies. And if we stop performing those services, in many cases the agencies will still do them themselves, much less effectively and much less efficiently. And so one of our other budget principles is that we will not adversely impact state agencies or cost shift to state agencies. And so that necessarily constricts the number of units within the department that we can look at for viable general fund reductions. Having said that, our first reduction is in our energy management services staff, which is a part of our plant management division currently. It is a staff that has historically done energy retrofits and projects around the state in state buildings, retrofitting with oftentimes money provided by the utilities, boiler systems, recommissioning boiler systems, installing control systems, and so forth. The logic here for reducing this is that it is not statutorily mandated, but more importantly, over the last few years, we've reached kind of the limit in what we're able to do. We have, over the last couple of years, asked for additional funds. For example, in last biennial budget, the governor's recommendation included $500,000 for investment funds. We're to the point where there's only so much fine-tuning you can do with existing building systems, and you need to start putting some money into them to make them more energy efficient. And that request was denied. We did, again, have a bonding request this year that did not make it past the governor's recommendations to create a fund where we could start to invest some of these funds. Without those monies, quite frankly, this staff is probably stymied in doing much more. We have achieved a 4.7% reduction in energy usage in state buildings simply by turning down the thermostats, having an extensive employee education program. We now have a clean computing program whereby we're using power management more effectively in our computers, a series of programs that will be ongoing, and we would continue to maintain those. We would also keep one individual in this office because guaranteed energy savings contracts with the utilities are a really still quite viable way of achieving energy savings, and we would keep a certified energy manager in place to manage those contracts. It would require reductions in staff of three positions. Recycling is an area that I think Representative Hortman knows we focus on quite extensively, and we're quite proud of our recycling operation. If we look for places to cut, one of the places we would simply cut is we would not replace some of the supplies as frequently, so recycling bins would not be replaced with the same schedule that we currently do. We would reduce our supplies in this area. We would not in any way cut back on our activities. We would not reduce staff. We would not reduce our emphasis on recycling. It's a relatively modest cut of $23,000. In the demographic services area, again, we're looking at this. Where can we find this 4%? The legislature gave us an appropriation last session to focus on Census 2010, and when we focus all of the resources of the demographer, in particular on that Census 2010, we found that we could hold a position open long enough to recoup their 4% of $19,000. The land management information system, just services, is always a topic of interesting conversation, especially before this committee. Quite frankly, when we were looking at a 3% reduction, we intended to keep this operation intact because the legislature spoke to us quite clearly last session that they wanted us to keep it intact and, in fact, provided additional funding beyond their base. What this cut would do would be simply to restore them to their base. It would reduce in 2009 the amount of additional money the legislature gave to the Land Management Information Center over and above their base from 2007.
But the 2007 base was a cut back from 2005, wasn't that 2007 base a cut or not?
Madam Chair, my recollection is that it was not. It might have been an attempted cut, which maybe didn't succeed. But I'll verify that for sure. In the Environmental Quality Board, it would be simply reducing one senior staff position in that area. quite frankly, the Environmental Quality Board is currently undergoing an analysis of its future. The public members of the board, together with the staff agency members, are in the midst of a strategic plan. There are many, many statutory authorities for the Environmental Quality Board that, quite frankly, from staffing and funding purposes, have not been fulfilled of late. There are also many, many other duplicative activities within state government that are exactly replicating what EQB was statutorily designed to do. We believe that this strategic plan will result in a refocus of the Environmental Quality Board, and we know that there are redundant activities going on at the EQB and elsewhere, and we believe that that will enable us to reduce at least one senior staff position. Administrative Management Services is just kind of all other. It's a 4% reduction, for example, in the General Fund for Management Analysis that does legislative studies. In sum total, when you spread it across all of the remaining operations of the department, it's $25,000. There's one final item that is not an operational item, but does help with the budget deficit. Last year, the legislature appropriated $885,000 for the relocation of the Department of Public Safety out of their headquarters in downtown St. Paul. At that time, we were envisioning moving them out of downtown, as there was an RFP on the street, and we had any number of very interesting proposals to move them, the entire headquarters as well as the Emergency Operations Center. As it turns out, none of those very interesting alternatives were affordable for the Department of Public Safety. So that resulted in our renegotiating the lease with the current landlord in downtown St. Paul. And we are just in the final stages of renegotiating that lease. And so we will not be needing that relocation money during this biennium, and it can be canceled. That's all I have, Madam Chair and members. If there are questions. Any questions? Thank you. Get one more. Oh,
Madam Chair, I was just going to say I have a bill up in a different committee at 4 o'clock, and so I'm going to be leaving. So I was wondering if we were done or what we were going to try to.
Let's try and get the Attorney General's office in. You'll leave when you have to. Oh, okay. Representative Portman, moves last week here to approve the minutes of 220, 221, 226, and 228.
Madam Chair, I think I can only move the ones I was here for. The 28th and the 20th. I think Representative Drozdowski wanted to move the other minutes.
Okay. Which two are you moving? 26. Okay, we'll figure it out. And Representative Drozdowski moves the others.
Thank you.
Okay.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Minutes are adopted. Okay. All right.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Rebecca Sparks. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Attorney General's Office. And as with many other agencies that you've been hearing from, we are a service agency. We provide legal services to all state agencies. And consequently, 80% of our budget is salary. So a cut of $1 million basically would mean that we would have to cut about 20 positions from our office staff, and we would cut from attorneys, probably support staff, and also paralegals. Some repercussions from doing these cuts would mean that we probably wouldn't be able to react as quickly as we have been when there's areas that need to be addressed immediately, such as the 35W bridge collapse. We might have to take more time in determining which requests from agencies we're going to be able to take. In particular, I went back over calendar year 2007 to see what kinds of returns we made to the state or what kinds of savings. During that year, we returned $10 million to the general fund. We defended state agencies against lawsuits and claims and saved $108 million that would have been paid out. We returned $4 million to counties and local units of government. Typically, those are costs associated with human services and also bankruptcy issues. Our Medicaid fraud unit recovered $5 million. We returned $11 million to consumers who had filed complaints with us. And in the area of small businesses and consumers, we represent those people when there are rate increases from utility companies. And we were able to either reduce or, because of our testimony, have them reduced or not granted at all, and that saved the people of Minnesota $25 million. Also, if you want me to, I can discuss very briefly partner agencies that we have that are not interagency agreements.
Now, I am interested in how those are arranged, and do they, and what effect it has on the financing of the agency.
In 1996, the Department of Finance strongly recommended that the Attorney General's Office enter partner agreements with particular agencies. There were 10 at that time. And the feeling was that they had specialized funding or funds that were not 100 funds that could be moved back through our billing system. At that point, the Attorney General's Office transferred funds from our budget to the various agencies. And as these partner agreements have continued or worked out, what we do is we try to, at the beginning of each fiscal year, talk to the department about what they assume they're going to have for legal services, and then we have a contract with them for that amount. Now, sometimes we go above, sometimes we go below. And overall, initially with partner agreements, we probably had about $11 million in 1997-98, and right now, in this particular fiscal year, it's going to be closer to $8 million. So that kind of fluctuates. And then all the rest of state agencies and boards are called pool, and those we do not charge for our services.
How does someone move from a pool to a partner?
You might move from a pool to a partner if the legislature ordered it, which the gambling board was one of those that moved over because the legislature determined that it should. We also, with risk management, that group became a partner because we transferred some of our work to that entity because they were more efficient at taking care of the items.
Okay.
That's just you and I.
I know.
Anything you want to ask?
Oh. Sure, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm trying to remember her name again.
Mrs. Sparks,
thank you. Those partner agencies and our partner departments, if that contract didn't exist, they'd obviously get that work contract in the private sector somewhere. Is that how they would do that, or what would happen?
In order to use attorneys outside of our office, the Attorney General has to do a special appointment. And typically, our billing rate is $101 an hour for attorneys. Sending it out is about $300 an hour with the rate with the office of the state, which is below what's typically being charged at this point.
Okay, so you're saying it would be more expensive to the state to go that way is what you're presuming. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. There's people who want. Okay, thank you very much. Apologize to the people who we called here and didn't get to. On this coming Thursday, we have bills up and revenue is going to present it. We'd really like to look at the tax compliance report. And then Tuesday on the 18th, we'll look at the Secretary of State, the OET, and revenue. Okay, thank you. Meeting adjourned.